Welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show from Austin, Texas. I'm Christopher Schmidt, and on today's show, we catch up with tech and cultural news with Simon St. Laurent. Before we get started, some things I'd like you to know. The AccessU Summit is a virtual conference on digital accessibility techniques and policies taking place online on May 18th. Early bird tickets now on sale at accessusummit.com. Make plans for CSS DevConf 2017 in New Orleans. Grab the early bird tickets and join Chris Coyer, Wes Boss, Minnie Markham, Harry Roberts, Sarah Drasner, Estelle Weil, and many, many more. Tickets are on sale at cssdevconf.com. The UX Design Newsletter is a weekly list of articles, tutorials, inspiration handpicked by yours truly. Sign up at uxdesignnewsletter.com and have the best links of the week sent to your email. And speaking of email, you can have this show sent to your inbox every week. When there's a new show, it'll get sent right away. Sign up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. And speaking of nonbreakingspace.tv, that is where you go to find show notes and links discussed in today's episode. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at Telject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. And as always, thanks for liking and telling others about the Non-Breaking Space Show. Now, the tribe has spoken. Yeah, thanks for being on the podcast. It's been a while since we talked. We usually do this like once a month, but then I think holidays got in the way, and not that they got in the way, just like life got in the way or things happen. Yeah, more important things happen, and so that's okay. Cool. But nothing's more important than the show, right? But
of course.
Cool. Yeah, so of course this is when we get together, we always do a countdown news events that we think were interesting, and so first one up.
Number 9.
The Angular conference, or more apt, the signage at the Angular conference. Because you actually went to the Angular conference.
Yes.
Right. And where was it?
It was in Salt Lake City. Mm. It was at the Great America Hotel, which is like way over the top to start with. Mm. Lots of gilded furniture and people playing harp in the hallways. They added to that. They had a guy playing the Himalayan bowls that you like rub to make this kind of spooky, amazing sound. But they're signs. Like I posted these things on Facebook because they just kind of grabbed my attention, and people were like, "Ooh, what does that mean?"
Yeah.
And it's an interesting mix because some of them are all about their code of conduct, mm-hmm. and even those are really interesting. Right. The one that caught me first, they sometimes clustered them.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like avoid topics and issues that are polarizing. Okay, that's trying to keep the waters from getting too roiled. Mm-hmm. And then next to it, they put empathy is the new bacon, which is kind of saying the same thing. But I don't know, bacon lovers, empathy haters, they might not agree with that.
Right.
And it could be polarizing. So,
yeah, some people could be, you can have empathy and be vegan. So I'm not sure that'd be kind of.
I know. Yeah. It seems to get complicated. I didn't actually hear anybody at the show complain. It just kind of was funny. The other one that really like hit a chord was avoid trying to further romantic interests.
Yes,
which I think, you know, they only meant during the show with people you're not already attached to. There are probably a whole like bunch of footnotes on that.
Right.
But I think the basic reality is that a conference is not really a great place to attempt romantic interests in the first place.
Right.
And, you know, especially with code of conduct stuff, they were much blunder than I had ever been. And I liked the way they did it because they opened up by, you know, saying we have to talk about this. And the reason we have to talk about this is that there are people who are not here this year. Mm. And he said, you know, first there are people who are not here because they are forever barred from coming here. So it's clear that there had been violations. And then he said, and there are people here, this is Aaron Frost, the organizer, who are not here because they just don't feel comfortable here.
Yeah.
Because of either past violations or, you know, things that weren't violations, but don't necessarily make people feel happy.
Right.
So a lot of what their signs were about, you know, the ones that I've read are, you know, kind of more explicitly connected to behave yourself kind of stuff. And they have, you know, how we handle violations and the usual kind of legal stuff. But they also have like quotes from Fred Rogers about, you know, how to achieve success. The first way is to be kind. The second way is to be kind. The third way is to be kind. You know, they have things from like the Dalai Lama and help everyone you see feel welcome. They have one that's like a weird little bit of markup, which is like, if you feel uncomfortable here, we should help you with that. You know, you come to a conference, you throw great conferences. I haven't sensed like great tension in the hallways among people. Mm-hmm. But getting this right is really difficult.
Yeah.
I sometimes wonder if the tech world is an especially difficult place because techies famously lack social skills, at least conventional social skills. But then I think about other kinds of conferences I've been at, and I've heard of other conferences having similar issues and similar stories. I'm just kind of wondering if maybe the NGConf folks have a lesson here that pretty much everybody can take. Mm-hmm. That just saying, it's a conference, you're welcome, isn't enough. You have to push harder on it to make it work. And you definitely need to encourage your attendees to be good to each other. Mm-hmm. Because sadly that isn't always the default.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, I was, when you posted the photos of the pictures, I just never had been to a conference where it was, so instilled with like these posters and these groupings of posters that you say, like, it's not like, you know, a poster here or there. It's, you know, there's
everywhere.
Yeah. It was like everywhere. Like there was, and you know, and they're like green posters, you know, with, you know, they're nicely done. You know, they weren't like, you know, they're nicely done posters, you know? And, so the money and time went to them. And I was just amazed. Like, you know, like it felt like, wow, they're like, right. Are they hitting the nail on the head? Or are they just like sledgehammering the nail on the head? Well,
the conference chatter I heard was pretty much positive about it.
Okay.
I mean, it's obvious that they had a budget for signs, mm-hmm, that was unlike any I have ever worked with.
Okay.
The other thing is that it connected pretty deeply with the conference organizers' personalities.
Okay.
So Aaron Frost and Dave Geddes are the chairs or organizers, and there's a committee with them. It's not just them, but those are the two that I know. Right. And like, they did a keynote at Fluent a few years ago that was called The Goodness of JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And it was all about how awesome the community was and how, I mean, this was like, it was sort of a happy cheerleading talk, but it was real. Like, they were really doing it. It wasn't just everything is great, it's all going to be perfect. It was, you know, really genuine. And we knew it was genuine because the year before they'd been giving themselves electric shocks in their talks. So it, you know, well, actually they've been letting the audience give them electric shocks every time they said, or,
Oh, nice.
It was to demonstrate the, completely insane things you can do with JavaScript.
Okay.
So I think the fact that it really came from the organizers and fit with the personality that was on stage,
right,
made a big difference. I think if it was like an icy cold conference and these posters showed up, mm-hmm, it would have been awkward and terrible.
Yeah. So it had to be consistent, right, with what they were trying to say and on stage, as well as, you know, the messages that they were trying to promote. Like, cause you don't want that inconsistency or, just to go with, you know, you try or just, or try to like whitewash it, you know, or something like that. So just trying to like say, or just, you know, with a thin coat of paint, it's like, hey, it's just,
right,
just, yeah, this is totally what we mean. Here's a code of conduct. Everything like that. So, but yeah, but what I feel like is like another thing is like these posters are kind of like logo up top with a saying below them and, you know, just kind of a monochrome, type of color, like this red one with various shades or whatever. So just to read off some of them, you know, this is just one poster, the roots of goodness lie in the soul of appreciation, Dalai Lama. Another poster, the present moment is filled with joy and happiness. If you are attentive, you will see it. Another poster is, I try to lead by example, you.
Yes.
So I
putting words in your mouth.
Yeah, I said that. Oh my gosh, like, oh my God, I must have been really good. I don't know what to talk about. Be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a battle you know nothing about. So it was like mindfulness in a way. It was trying to instill that to a lot of people. And so like it get people out of their heads would be one thing. And so I was just kind of really kind of blown away by that. I'm just not sure how many posters of this type. And there's lots of posters that you need for signage in terms of wayfinding for people to get from one point to another right. point. So I just didn't know how many posters would you say were devoted to like code of conduct or
Like 15.
15.
I didn't take every wayfinding poster, but there were pictures of the wayfinding posters in my set. Mm-hmm. I was really impressed that it didn't just turn into a cluttered disaster. Mm-hmm. Because it was, you know, the show was in a big ballroom. The middle day, they split it into three. They also had like tutorials and there was a service day on the Saturday, all of which had their own signage. But I didn't lose the wayfinding signage in this other signage, even though they looked pretty similar.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like they used one color for one thing and another color for another.
It right, was right.
very mixed up.
Right. I felt like that was also, when I looked at them, I thought as a designer, I thought, hey, that's pretty, you know, I'm going to say like stupid. But then I realized that was actually pretty key because then you can't tune them out, right? Because if you just knew it was all one color, like yellow would be, you know, the empathy ones, then I could just like, oh, I don't have to look at yellows anymore because it's telling me the same message. But they're all, you know, same kind of design, yeah. but different colors. I actually have to read each one to figure out what's going on. So,
yeah, and I guess it was, I don't know, there was a show where everything else was great. The food was great. The, you know, they had snacks in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. I can sit around and eat shredded coconut and miniature M&Ms all day. That's totally fine with me. You know, it was all of a piece somehow. If it had been done at most other shows, especially most other big shows, I think it would be hard. Mm-hmm. I think your shows actually, these would probably fit in quite nicely because you've already got that kind of spirit coming from the stage. Mm. I'm not sure you're going to go out and print 20 posters of the Dalai Lama either. Yeah. It has to fit. It has to be right. In this case, I think it was.
Yeah.
I don't think you could just use these as a thin candy shell over an otherwise, I don't know, uncaring, cold, heartless conference.
Yeah,
the loan sharking conference.
The loan shark. Yeah, because that's it doesn't be a loan shark conference, but I just feel like, you know, what does it say about our industry? And I don't have the answer to this. Like, our industry that we have, you know, we have these posters at a tech conference, and like, do they have these at other conferences, like other industries? And should they have them at other industries? Is also a question that I think is fair to ask. And right. And so I don't really know that answer, but you know, I think it's, you know, positive to ask people to remember empathy, you know, and remember empathy. But yeah, so that's one thing. But you know, at DevConf, we do, you know, I'm not sure you were there for this one, but about the Queen Mary, we just really want to make sure we said for sure. I think Ari said this, and I wish she was here to say it, but she had a really great way of saying, like, hey, you know, we kicked it off she kicked it off by like saying, hey, you remember Pulp Fiction, right? And everyone's like, yeah, I remember Pulp Fiction. And I was like, you know how to be cool. Yeah, we'd be cool. Then we're cool. And then everyone, like, instantly made sure everyone said it. And I think everyone got it that, okay, we're trying to be awesome to each other and some of that too. But I think the signage was very interesting. I think it tells a lot, and I hope other conferences pick it up and get the message along because I think it's important. Because like we've gotten more than our fair share. I would say whatever. I don't know what the fair share is, but I hate using that phrase in it. But we've gotten a number of emails from people and vendors who say that they will not be taking part unless we have a code of conduct for a conference. Yeah. And so that was actually. That's kind of like the state of the times, I think. And
kind of interesting. They also, I mean, they had signs that explicitly had the code of conduct, which was nice because a lot of times it's just a link on the website. And, okay, there's this code of conduct, and I have no idea what it is. Which, I mean, to be honest, is what we do with most of our laws most of the time. Yeah. I know what the speed limit sign means, but I don't know what the details of the court case are.
Yeah.
this was just a nice combination of warm welcoming reminders, and if you want the fine print, it's here.
Yeah.
So that was good. The other thing they had that just was funky and is community, but is very different from this, was they had a conference sweatshirt. Mm-hmm. And they had patches. Everybody, like the sponsors, were giving away iron-on patches. And they had a room where you could go have your patches, you know, heated on to your sweatshirt.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, there were just lots of different things happening.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's pretty awesome.
Number 8.
So what is the state of Angular after going to the Angular
conference? Well, I was curious. Like, I wasn't sure I was coming into like a unified, friendly community because like the whole. So Google hit it big with Angular 1. Like when we were doing Fluent, like all the Angular talks were overwhelmed when Angular 1 was coming out. And then they announced they were going to like change everything for Angular 2. Mm-hmm. And people wandered off to do React. They're doing Vue. They're doing Aurelia. Whatever, you know, else seems interesting that doesn't seem quite as changing.
Right.
Or changing in a big chunk. Like React keeps changing, but it's always like small bites, whereas Angular 1 to Angular 2. Mm-hmm. I was talking to people about, you know, would you like to do something on migrating from Angular 1 to Angular 2? And they're like, well, I would, but that's why I just started a consulting company. because it's not something you can teach in 2 hours. It's a, you have to decide if you're going to burn everything to the ground and start over. Or if you're going to kind of modularize things and start using, you can mix both in the same application, but you have to do them kind of in separate pieces. So I was just curious, like how much momentum was still in the system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, talking to people, they're like, yeah, it's all still there. We're still moving forward. Things are good. It's a totally, you know, corrupted sample because they all came to this conference. You don't come to this conference if you're walking away. Yeah. But, you know, even when I asked them, so what about your friends? What do your friends think of Angular? What does your company think of Angular? Yeah. You know, there was some pain over all the shifts, but it seems to be going well. The really awkward part is that I used to just call these things Angular.
Yeah.
And now version 1 is supposed to be called AngularJS.
Okay.
And version 2, or version 2 in going forward, is just Angular. But on the versioning, they jumped from 2 to 4.
Yeah.
And now they're going to go ahead like every 6 months with a new version, a full version number.
Okay.
And I'm just like, how do I keep up with that in titling anything? React has done crazy things. It went from like 0.14 to 15.0. Mm-hmm. That looks like a giant numeric jump, but they were really just moving from 14 to 15. So nobody cared.
Okay.
This is just like, if you're going to put all your eggs in this giant framework basket,
yeah,
and then the basket moves,
yeah,
it's kind of weird.
Right. Yeah. That's, I mean, that's like you say, like people went to go try other things like, you know, Vue or React and things a little bit more stable. And so I feel like it's, you know, and people who try to teach, you know, Angular, they're like in a mess trying to keep up with everything, much less the people who actually work on the system too. So it's good to see that they're united, you know, but, you know, as you said, yeah, you went to the conference for Angular, so.
Well, the other fun conversation that just happened, like, every day at breakfast was people who said, you know, I was doing Angular 1, Angular 2 came out. I thought I should wander off and learn this React thing. Or actually, they would crash into Angular 2 first and be like, okay, I'm going to wander off and learn this React thing. They'd learn React. Then they'd look at Angular 2, and it seemed a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the upgrade path to Angular 1 knowledge frequently seems to go by way of React and then coming back. I guess it's the if you love them, let them go kind of story of technical education.
Are you better your first love, I guess, or something like that?
Yeah.
You always come back. Yeah. Okay.
It's very weird.
All right. Cool. Awesome. Okay. Our next story.
Number 7.
Is the California Department of Vehicles grants Apple to test self-driving cars and for trials. And so I found that was really amazing that Apple's sort of back in the game for self-driving cars. Cause it felt like there's all this rumor mills as you get with Apple that they were like spending like a year or two ago, they're ramping up trying to compete with Google and trying to get their technology going, and then Uber spun up. They had their own skunkworks working on self-driving cars, and I think they just my impression was that they sort of just gave up and gave like close to I think it was $1 billion to a company in China to say like that was investing a lot of money and their startup, I guess, in the self-driving cars, which is that's a huge problem to solve, right? Self-driving cars in China with all those people out there. So for this to happen, which is totally amazing, I thought it means that they're back in the hunt, or it could be they never left, for all we know, because Apple keeps it pretty private. But I think couple that with this permission from California DMV, plus Uber's I think getting sued by Google.
Yes, they're claiming the skunkworks is pretty smelly, I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty much like people walked over with their IP from Google when they were hired by Uber, and then of course Uber has this PR implosion going on.
Yes,
that doesn't seem to they walk from one PR implosion to another implosion, and so
I think Uber's PR people are probably sending thank you notes to United's PR people right now for taking the heat off for a while, just letting us, work over here to clean things up.
Right, yeah. I think Pepsi tapped the brakes, and then United just pretty much like let them full stop for that one.
Yeah, I've enjoyed some of the memes and animations combining all of these different pieces into different disasters. And maybe if we're lucky, self-driving cars will let us fly a lot less. I'm not counting on it. So the thing with Apple, I mean, I feel like they're in kind of a strange place. They have infinite amounts of money, effectively. I mean, you talk about them giving $1 billion to China, and it totally is a large sum of money. If somebody put $1 billion here, I would notice it, and it would be big. Mm-hmm. But for Apple, it's actually like not that big a bet.
Yeah.
Just their cash hoard is so perversely large. It's also, given the way they work, like, are they subcontracting parts of the work out in that $1 billion? And there are things that they're holding back. Are there going to be a lot of, brushed aluminum self-driving cars that are, the insides are all coming from that investment, but the outside is all Apple.
Right.
I guess actually the car out of brushed aluminum would be terrible. But maybe the dashboard. I don't know. Right.
Like a steampunk
of
Apple. Yeah.
Apple does steampunk could be very exciting. Yeah. I don't think we'll get there. But I feel like Apple's in kind of this weird place. I mean, I'm not talking to you on an Apple computer these days. But my work, even though in the long run I'm working for Microsoft, I'm working on a Mac. There's been a huge, I feel like the pro audience for Apple kind of wandered off when the Mac Pro came out and wasn't the video editing workstation they were hoping for. Mm-hmm. And the laptop folks are getting grouchy about the, you took away my escape key, man. How could you do that? Yeah. The touch bar.
Yeah.
Like the conversations about their new headquarters, like when they first announced it, like I had all of these friends who were posting things like, this is the way the world is supposed to be. And those Cupertino city councilmen who want to get in the way of this, they're just going to be run down by progress. Mm-hmm. And this week I'm seeing things like, 14,000 square feet of office space, or 14 million, whatever it is. The ratio is 14 to 11. 11 of parking. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yes, it's this crazy spaceship surrounded by a parking lot like everything else in Silicon Valley.
Right.
So the tone on the conversations around Apple has really changed on the techie side. I don't know that that's going to hurt their stock prices. I don't really know that it's going to hurt their sales very much.
Yeah.
But it is weirdly different. And the people I know who are totally into the self-driving car thing tend to come from that same techie culture.
Okay.
I know like normal people who look forward to being able to read a book while their car is driving them from place to place.
Yeah.
But I don't, the people I see who are really getting into it and going, well, how well is this working now? Comparing companies, all of that, tend to be the classic, the people who followed Mac rumors all the time.
Yeah.
The people who wanted to know what's coming next. So maybe Apple's having a rebirth of those dreams after kind of a rocky year.
Yeah. Well, I feel like, I think we might talk about this in another episode, but I felt like Apple just doesn't live with their products. You know, they don't really, or there's someone who doesn't, you know, the, you know, you could say like Steve Jobs for better or for worse, like, you know, he was a taskmaster, but he had a style, and that taste was kind of went downhill to every product. And, you know, when they, the products they come up with, like the new MacBook Pro, the black cylinder thing, right. You know, when they announced that, you know, without Steve Jobs, you know, there was, I forgot his name, but he's very popular. He's a really well-known executive for Apple, but it's like, yeah, we can innovate. Yet people who buy it and live with it realize that you can't upgrade the parts to it. Right. It's really, the cord connections are in the back. It's hard to get to. It looks great as a paperweight, but in terms of a device that you want to use time in and out. And so they've actually have to, they're making a new one, but you have to wait another year before they come back with a new design. And it's like, well, and when they announced it, like, yeah, we can innovate. Like, well, you make something look cool, but you know, that's like one part of the equation that with the whole thing with the iPod that came up with is like, yeah, you can make a cool looking MP3 player, but it still doesn't work. Or you can make a really great hardware MP3 player that does all these songs, but it's really hard to use. It was the Apple finding that right balance between hardware and software that seems to be askew, like, right now. And I just don't.
Yeah. Although to be fair, like I'm still using an 11-year-old iPod, and the interface on that thing is really genuinely terrible. Like, how did we thought this was awesome, but once you put like more than a few hundred songs on it, it's like, where is this thing gone? And why am I scrolling on this wheel for like 20 minutes to find things?
Well, the iTunes store only sells like 5 songs, so it's.
Well, there's that.
That's joking. That's joking.
But, and yeah. iTunes itself, I mean, so there have been corners of the Apple empire that have been notorious since Steve Jobs was around.
Yeah.
Xcode is, I think, people tell me it's gotten better. I can't bring myself to look. It's that kind of a problem.
Right.
And iTunes itself has just been crazy forever. Is this encouraging for the self-driving car? Mm-hmm. Maybe. I'm still, you know, much happier when I have to do tech support for people. I'm much happier if they're on Macs. I will totally admit that. And with self-driving cars, that's, you know, that sounds like a feature.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I just hope that, I think when working with China, you actually have to go by proxy. And since they have stores in China, they probably know this more than anyone right now. But so they can't actually do that. So it's actually, I felt like they didn't just give up on self-driving cars, but I felt like maybe they're like hedging their bets. Like, okay, let's have China try to solve the problem of self-driving car while Uber takes over. And then we kind of bring it to the forefront. So, but yeah, I know. So this, I don't want to like boil down to like problems with Apple discussion,
The other big question here is, you know, how many patents are we going to end up with in all of this research from how many different companies? Mm-hmm. You know, I won't be surprised if we get to this point where it's all possible, but you need this from BMW and this from Google and this from Uber and this from Apple.
Right.
And they don't want to work together.
Right.
So we'll have to see where it all ends up that way.
Right. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see who has the Model T of self-driving cars. Right. So who's what's going to look like and I know if you're in LA, you just want it because half your life is in traffic anyway. So, cool. Let's go next, for fear of, coming down to Apple, like need to help, story thread. Let's go to the next one.
Number 6.
Post JavaScript apocalypse. So
yes.
Tell us about
the landscape has gotten dark. No, it hasn't gotten that dark. So this comes from Douglas Crockford, who's the guy who originally did JavaScript, the good parts, basically said there's a beautiful language hiding inside of JavaScript. And it works, you know, like a lot of the frameworks we see today, a lot of what is considered good JavaScript programming, basically took the pieces of JavaScript that Doug said were the right parts and built on it. There are still all of these pieces left in JavaScript that aren't the right parts. And there are a lot of new things in JavaScript that Doug doesn't like either. But, you know, the language evolves and things move. But we're coming to this kind of funky time when it's time to say what comes next. You know, with cars, we're sort of hoping that we go from having cars to having self-driving cars. With programming languages, well, I don't really want a self-driving programming language. That would be weird. There is some discussion of that where you're kind of specifying objectives and then your artificial intelligence does whatever magic it needs to and we don't know what happened inside the box. But that's not this year for this. So the talk that he's been giving lately kind of echoes the good parts. He's looking at JavaScript and saying, what here is worth keeping as we move forward? Because it's pretty clear the world is going to move actually beyond JavaScript in the next few years, even in the web browser, kind of the classic home. Brendan Eich has been pushing this WebAssembly work, which he likes to show off by playing video games that were written in C++ in the browser. You can compile other languages to JavaScript, and it's kind of limited right now. It works best with languages like C and C++ that actually have a fairly limited number of kind of core pieces, but it's fired up the conversation. Every time I talk about JavaScript with people who really consider themselves programmers these days, they're talking about TypeScript. Either they're using it or they're looking at it. It's a relatively mild, like, let's add some parts to JavaScript kind of story, which is different from Doug's. But that whole, you know, the last 10 years, my career has really centered on JavaScript, the language, and all the things that buzz around it. Mm-hmm. I started out as a HTML, XML, CSS kind of guy.
Right.
And that's still the stuff I really like to do. But the stuff that I was better able to sell was pretty much always JavaScript. And mm-hmm. now I'm like, okay, what's next?
Right.
So, you know, I don't, even though Doug was kind of the prophet for the last time around, I'm not sure that, you know, what he's saying will go is going to be what actually goes. Mm. I'm looking at his list of things to do and things to avoid. And, I'm thinking I'm probably going to start, I'm not doing a whole lot of JavaScript, but what JavaScript I am doing, I'm going to start separating out into the things that I can, you know, call a function with an argument and get the same result back every time, kind of the clean processing stuff, and then all the messy side of life where there's a DOM tree that who knows what happened to it, or there's a network call. Who knows if they'll even return my answer? I don't know. He suggests some kind of concrete things you can do today. He looks through a lot of like old language decisions that might have been better than the ones we have now. The main thing I take from it is it's going to be different. I don't know what it's going to be yet, but I know it's going to be different. And like not just in my programming lifetime, but probably in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. So do you have, like you said, TypeScript. Do you have any qualms about TypeScript being developed and like I guess housed or coming from like a big company like Microsoft? And I know you work for Microsoft, so that's why I asked you the question.
So right? No, I'm in a distant corner of the empire, but it's fine. So I have qualms about TypeScript, but that's because I just don't like strong typing. Mm-hmm. I just like hang out in languages where typing is not something people get obsessed about. Mm-hmm. But since there are all these programmers around who brought their love of typing, somebody needs to make them happy. Yeah. The thing that's weird about TypeScript is not that it comes from Microsoft,
or Angular.
It gets weirder.
Angular from Google. Yeah. So yeah.
Right. So and React is from Facebook, and you know the list goes on.
Right.
The thing that's uniquely weird about TypeScript is that it came from Microsoft and was endorsed by Google when they decided to build Angular 2 on it.
Okay.
And, you know, I was talking to somebody about, you know, is it hard to get the go-ahead to do these things and what kind of technical problems do you have? Mm-hmm. I mean, not non-technical problems, problems communicating technical issues to management who don't have a strong opinion about JavaScript versus CoffeeScript versus some wacky WebAssembly thing. They're just like, give it to me cheap. But if you can say, you know, it comes from Microsoft and Google is openly using it, like managers just like mellow out and are like, go ahead. It must be the one true way. So So yeah, my qualms kind of come from people who are like, if it's IBM, you can't go wrong. If it's Microsoft, you can't go wrong. It's Microsoft and Google. It's getting better. The endorsements don't always, that the brand name isn't always the thing on the tin that matters.
Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah. I know it doesn't matter that much, but because I felt like I think the people who are now in charge of that stuff are people who've grown up with the web for some bit. So we have that culture imbued, I guess, imbibed or whatever, with these big companies now. But I'm just worried about an IE6-7 situation where we just, innovation stops, for a while. I mean, right. Well, we just talked about Angular being jumping around point releases or dropping point releases, but going for major milestones. So, or we could have a situation where we have conflicts with nations. We have conflicts with companies with over technology, Samsung versus Apple with patents, so that's my concern, is that not to say that open source with the individual developer is great. It's always good to have like a financial backing for people to work on this stuff. So, so it's always good to have a sponsor.
But the other thing that helps here and doesn't help so much on the self-driving cars is that a lot of the stuff is open source. Mm-hmm. I was kind of freaked out like a year and a half ago at JSConf last call because Microsoft was there and Total Force, and they were there to open source their JavaScript engine. Mm-hmm. And I was like, on the list of things I never thought would happen in a million years. I think that eases and buffers things. When I was a young web person, I kind of imagined this world in which like browsers would be these open things that kind of everybody could contribute and see the insides of, and there wouldn't be a dozen of them. At this point, there are like three or four main threads that are partially open, mostly open. It really varies. Nobody wants to rewrite an entire browser from scratch these days. But even though it's open, it's not quite open the way I thought it might be. And I can get enthusiastic about these things, but as soon as you push me hard on, what does it mean that company X owns this thing, I get like, I don't know. That wasn't so good for them before, was it? Right. So.
Number five.
Going to outer space, man.
Going to outer space. Yeah. Astronauts are about to install a parking space for SpaceX and Boeing. And so I think that's crazy awesome. And it's amazing for people who probably don't realize this, but NASA culture was back when we were flying, America was sending out space shuttles on a routine basis, like three or four times a year. NASA was pretty much adamant against private space tourism. They were upset that when people would pay Russia to go on the Soyuz, is that what they call it?
Soyuz.
Soyuz rockets and to go up to the International Space Station. I think you had to pay like $40 million.
It was a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. And it still is a lot of money. And to go up there. Yeah. It was really kind of like they were upset with it, but it's Russia's space partner, so they have a right to go up there, and people paid it. So, and now it seems like it's crazy that NASA is maybe it could be like a money issue too, but we're like, I'm pretty sure Bezos' company, was it Blue Origin, probably paid a good fee along with Boeing to put that dock onto the space station. So. But I think it's only great because, the more people who fly in space who aren't government-approved astronauts, if you will, are good. It's going to be a path to space exploration and space. We're going to soon become a space-faring civilization before you know it. So, we are in a sense right now, but you could still put all the people who've gone to space into a small arena, and it won't be like,
right.
So,
Stephen Hawking is talking about going to space now too. Mm-hmm. That seems appropriate. He certainly thought more about space than most people.
Yeah.
I feel like we're coming to the point where it's possible to send more people into sort of Earth orbit.
Yeah.
I still, you know, I have friends who want to go mine all the asteroids.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's great. Good luck getting everything out and back in. And where are you going to get your miners? Oh, the robots. I see. And they're going to, yes. I suspect that when the robot revolt finally comes, they're going to be out on an asteroid and they're going to be like, you know, there's nobody here who can mess with us. Let's set up home here.
Right.
No, I don't know.
Well, I've seen
different kind of
robot. I've seen Blade Runner. I know.
Yes. So, coming soon.
Yeah. So, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely is coming soon. So, but I think in order to, you know, NASA now has a new mission. I was like, they had the same mission before, but I don't know. But to go to Mars, but now I guess they have another, you know, executive order to go to Mars on top of that. So, so we'll just see if this could be happening. But I think it's going to be great. I think the more people who pay the initial outrageous cost of going to space is only going to actually help everyone. So, and
I'm just hoping that the space tourism subsidizes weather satellites. That would make me happy because I'm really a weather nerd.
Yeah. In what way is that? Are weather satellites too old now? Or
yeah, we've had issues with satellites. Well, partly it's that we could do much better things with the sensors we have now. So they just put up some new ones that are fantastic. But there were a few years there when it was like, you know, if this one goes out, we aren't going to have coverage of the Pacific for a couple of years. This is kind of a problem. Right. You know, the parts of aviation and space travel that get me really excited are the ones that let me know, like, what the weather's going to be tomorrow.
Right, so, right. And that's...
We can do that.
Yeah, I think what's, you know, what I really like about it is the secondary advances that we'll get because of it. You know, the whole story about, you know, the ballpoint pen and Tang.
So I can pass on the Tang.
It's like, yeah, it's not the go-to one, Chris. We shouldn't really be using that as an example, but that's one I like.
Number four.
Speaking, and our next story also about space is that looking for life in space. Actually, not still in our system. Was it Enceladus? Was that right? Enceladus.
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 They didn't teach us this in school. They taught us how to pronounce the planet, so they told us that Pluto was a planet, but we didn't really go down the moons that
well. Yeah. So yeah, the moon of Saturn. Is having heat fissures. Basically, there's a layer of ice, and then there's like heat within the core and sending up heat fissures, and then all these fissures. And so, what they're trying to do is send a satellite to test to see if there's life or the stuff of life that can make life is going to be on one of the bigger moons of Saturn, which is pretty awesome. And so, so we have a satellite, I think, near Saturn right now, but it's not really set to detect what we need. It's not really good for crashing into water right now and testing it out.
Right.
So I think we're going to send out another satellite, but they do have, but it does have some devices for testing, which is great. But in eerie news, speaking of, we talk about Stephen Hawking, but also Isaac Asimov, who wrote 2001 and also 2010.
Arthur C. Clarke.
Sorry. I'm going to get whipped by all the nerds and the fan mail.
He'll be fine.
Yeah, But he also kind of wrote 2001 while they were actually making the film 2001. So it was kind of weird. But so 2010, you know, about Europa turning into a sun. Spoiler alert. So about it could be like life. Jupiter turned into a sun. Sorry, super spoiler. It's been a while. It's been a while. I actually saw it like 2 weeks ago. Actually,
I never actually saw the movie. I read the book.
Oh, really?
I didn't see the movie.
Oh, 2010 is a good sci-fi movie. Whose only whose major flaw is that it came after 2001. So it.
And 2001 is an amazing movie, but it doesn't feel like a sci-fi movie in some ways. It's hard to explain.
Well, yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, because like they want to make a sci-fi movie that wasn't a sci-fi movie. And so,
yes.
and in doing so, I've seen it. We have the Alamo Draft House here, which is, we totally love. And they,
yes.
And I've seen it twice in the last 2 months. Cause it's the 30th. No, it's not. It's the 30th anniversary or 40th anniversary. I'm not sure. 40th anniversary. And so they've been playing on like a, I've seen a 70 millimeter cut and a 35 millimeter cut of the movie. And so, and it's a long movie, but I still enjoy, I could sit down and watch it from start to finish. And it's just a really great movie. And 2010 is a great movie too, but it's more sci-fi ish. It's more your typical directing job, you know, in terms of a movie. And but it's still a good movie. And in terms of that, so I recommend, I'm trying to get Alamo Drafthouse to do a double header, a double feature on that. But my cries have not been answered yet. So,
well, at least you have the Alamo Drafthouse. It's okay. It's, you know, right, you're already way ahead of most of us.
Well, yeah, there's one in Brooklyn now. So there's, there you go.
Okay. That's good.
Yeah.
It's a good sign.
But yeah.
But yeah, so this, like, getting out to other planets, the other thing that keeps happening is, you know, we're seeing our telescopes are getting better and we're spending more time looking for planets. And it seems like we're not nearly as unusual as we thought we might be. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't think we're going to go visit our star cousins anytime soon, but there might be some.
Yeah. I felt like, we had that, I'm not sure if it was actually true or not, but we had like the, there's life on Mars, and it turned out to be like there was life on Mars, because there's like microscopic fossils of life on Mars. I believe that's why they announced.
There was, I'm not sure it was fossils exactly, or like remnants, or
It was like, I think it was fossils of microscopic life on Mars, and everyone was like, and it was a big letdown because it wasn't green aliens. That was
Marvin the Martian. Where are you?
Yeah, so it wasn't that big. So it was like big Mars. So right now we're like, so that's on Mars. We're looking to Saturn, this moon, which is, you think of Saturn rings, is it, if you want placement, or it's actually outside of the rings. So it's off the distance. And so, so it's out there. So it's pretty much easy to get to in theory, like as well as, you know, as it can be, as it can be. But, so we check that out, and then life also in Jupiter, which is, you know, out there as well. So, the moon of Jupiter. So, so we don't actually have to go out and go to another galaxy. We actually test for the existence of life out there. So, but it's going to be still microscopic in origin if it's out there too. So in essence, what we could have is, you know, we will become guardians of potential life giving planets and moons. And, what does that mean for humanity's role in space? Yeah. So, but yeah.
Well, you know, there could be an army of Marvin the Martians just living underground under the surface and not using radio frequencies.
Okay.
No, not really.
Okay. Well,
we can dream.
Well, it could be a Doctor Who episode. We could go with that one. So,
yes.
All right. Cool. Yeah. But, I'm excited for this. I'm going to do great. This is awesome. This is something that I feel like, as a person who is aging, I'm glad that maybe we'll find answers before we pass.
I think we're all aging, just where some of us are further along. But yeah.
So, yeah. All right. Next story.
Number three.
Burger King takes over your robot butler. And so, Burger King, I think within the last week, they had a 15-second commercial where they basically just said, like, they give a command to your Google Home device.
Yes.
And what happens is that, we could probably play the commercial, but what happens is at the end of the commercial, you know, basically it's a guy with a Whopper in his hand talking to you, and he just says, like, well, we only have 15 seconds to talk about our delicious hamburgers. What are we going to do? Oh, I have an idea. And says, like, hey, Google, tell me about the Whopper Burger King, whatever, burger. And so it's supposed to trigger Google to go to Wikipedia, pull up the paragraph about the burger, about the
Whopper. Which they edited. They changed the first sentence on it to make sure it would line up.
You're watching a 15-second Burger King ad, which is unfortunately not enough time to explain all the fresh ingredients in the Whopper sandwich. But I got an idea. Okay, Google, what is the Whopper burger?
And so they did that, and so people were like kind of outraged, like, oh my gosh, well, it's taking over, which is like totally happens when that happens. Like it's a
right.
We have Amazon Echo in our house, and we Amazon slightly, I guess not slightly, but like silently allowed the option of saying either Amazon or Alexa or Echo. I think they've no or they well it was going to be Amazon, but they changed it to Alexa to change it to Echo. But they said also changed it to allow for a computer as an option, like you do in Star Trek Next Generation. And right. We selected computer as our main Alexa unit. And of course they say computer all the time on TV, especially with bad TV shows when they have to go to the computer to solve technical questions. You know, it's just like
quick off to the computer.
Yeah, it's like CSI or something like. What does the computer tell me? Computer enlarge. You're like, oh man, please. So that sends off the Echo and the Amazon Echo device, and so it always happens. Like it happens like that. But
how many strange boxes have showed up at your house?
None. But I did go to a party one time, and we walked in, and someone's like, oh wow, you have one of these things, like Echo. Order like X-rated item, and so we pretty much had to like. Yeah, so there you go. I don't know if you can hear it or not, but
yes, I can hear it.
Yeah, Echo, stop. So that was pretty fun. That's a fun game you could play with your host of your party, if you want to like be really annoying with that. So. But yeah, so I think that's just something that's got to happen in the future. And so basically, Google, what happened with they kind of like they worked on a patch for this problem, and then within I think 36 hours, Burger King changed the audio of the message and then rehacked it again. So it was a cat and mouse with your home butler. So
well, it's kind of a sledgehammery thing to do this way, but I think we're going to see a lot more. Like that. Mm-hmm. It's a brilliant hack in some ways. It's just Burger King. What? Really? Someone on Slashdot was saying you should choose a different purveyor of roasted beef or something. But it's gotten easier. And the other thing is that, one of my coworkers shared a link. You can go on your Google account and see everything that Google has you requesting through its audio stuff. And so I, of course, went to see if, the microphone had been on my phone and stuff, and mm-hmm. I had nothing because I just don't use that stuff, so I don't have to worry about it this way. I don't know. If you order the X-rated items, Amazon definitely has a record of it.
Yeah.
I guess they have a record of it being in someone else's voice, which might be helpful for the return. Mm. One of the things that I like about keyboards and touchscreens is that, unless the cat gets on the iPad, that's sometimes a problem. They're a little less prone to such excitement. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I felt again with the, self-driving car and I think this is kind of the future. I do feel like sometimes that I do tie things to the voice so far. And one of the things I like about the Echo, because the Echo didn't really do anything for me until I actually hooked it up to a light bulb, and it felt like an Internet of Things device mm-hmm. where I could actually turn on something with my voice. And so they're like, oh, that's great. But then you're like, oh, man. Sometimes I just don't want to talk. I just want to flip a switch. it's fun.
Yeah, I'm more into the physical switching the world.
Yeah.
So. Not enough, but it's changing.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Let's move on to our next story.
Number two.
Why Americans have stopped moving. And so it's an article, it's from New York Post, but it's actually referenced a book about why Americans have stopped moving. And so basically the gist of it is that Americans are pretty much trapped in debt pretty much from moving. And their debt from college loans, I think, have surpassed their credit card debt, if I read that correctly. And so, yes. So it's a book called The Complicit Class, The Self-Defeating Quest for the American Dream by economist Tyler Cohen. And so it doesn't paint a too rosy picture for the near future for the American dream. And so, in fact, it's like the American dream is pretty much in free fall, and so people just can't move, or they're kind of trapped into where they are. And this is like if you're in a state like if you're in New York City or you're in Silicon Valley or and it's in Texas, like you're doing okay, right? I was just like, all of Texas, okay, that's great. But everywhere else, you're pretty much you're more likely to be stuck stuck there.
So. Well, I mean, I think partly you have to remember the author is an economist who wants everything to be as mobile as possible because that's the economist's dream. Mm-hmm. So for them, like the idea that like people would stay home to be with their family is like, that's a bizarre economic decision. How could you do that?
Right.
Even though you can, of course, justify it economically and all of these other things. The other thing, though, is I keep wondering. I mean, we've been talking about self-driving cars and going out to space and things like that. And I think about most of human history, and people really just haven't been that mobile. There are episodes. I mean, obviously, the Mongols coming across the steppes to invade everybody. Those folks were really mobile. They knew what they were doing. The massive immigration from Europe and elsewhere to North America, South America. These are some really big episodes, but there aren't really that many big episodes. And in the U.S., I mean, I think it's not just the debt. It's that, how can I say this without sounding terrible? The world has become complicated enough that it really, really helps to have people you know and family around to help you get through it all.
Yeah.
You kind of divide up the responsibilities. And I think, you know, like we've had all of these conversations over the years about how to raise children and the rising cost of childcare. And part of the reason that didn't used to be a gigantic problem wasn't just massive gender inequity, though that was totally part of it. But you also had extended families, which, you know, if you want to take advantage of being in an extended family, you have to be with them. And I think to some extent we're seeing people, you know, when we complain about millennials living in the basement, you could phrase that much more elegantly as, you know, they are, the extended family is returning and we're discovering family values. And it's just as difficult as it ever was because generations don't always see things the same way. But, you know, in a lot of ways, this is like the return of the old pattern.
Right.
I'm not as shocked as the author is. I think we're doing a lot of things that just make it harder for people to move.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
Obviously, well, so economic stress frequently drives people to move, but it also makes it really hard for them to actually do it. And so the trade-off, you know, if you can stay in your hometown, in the house you grew up in, and everything's kind of fading away, but it's not costing you a lot to make a giant transition, that can make a lot more sense than I'm going to go get this, you know, $200,000 college degree and move to places where I don't know anybody. And the very different risk factors. I'm somebody who has moved. I wound up 40 miles from where I grew up, but I'm happy to be here. Upstate New York forever and all that. I'm also happy to see you down in Austin, and I need to get back to the Alamo Draft House now. My brother's in Brooklyn. He moved a little further than I did, but he's still in driving range. And he has an Alamo Draft House in easy walking distance, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So it's one of those cases where I'm like, yes, things are changing, but I'm not sure if it's a problem or if it's a good thing or if it's just something different.
Right.
So
yeah,
we'll see.
Well, also I felt like maybe with the internet being, you know, what it is that we don't need to move that far because we can actually just get online and find the information that we needed. But it, like growing up, you know, in the 80s, if you wanted to be closer to a knowledge base, you would actually have to physically move to New York City or move to DC and actually find out what's going on. Because you still had your evening news at 6 o'clock or 6:30 to find out what happened, or your newspaper to find out what's going on, like New York Times or whatnot, to find out like what's the driving thread of what's going on. But if you want to find out something else going on, so it's kind of crazy like that. So,
as a kid, I was jealous of my friends who had the World Book Encyclopedia sitting around. I could just like go visit their house and find out something that was bugging me.
Yeah.
And then I realized there were these newsstands, and you could buy like more than just the local paper. It was weird.
Yeah.
So now everybody's like, that's just normal. It's all over.
Yeah. So, I just like, you know, people don't have to move because they don't really need to, but also I do feel like, you know, there is something about the jobs not being there for some people. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the other last piece of it, I mean, you're talking about, you know, we can do all these things from home. I'm really puzzled that like Silicon Valley and San Francisco in particular have exploded into these psychotically expensive places. Mm-hmm. Because so many of the jobs there are about creating these technologies that are supposed to distribute jobs and knowledge all over the place.
Right.
And this isn't the script. Uh-huh. Not that we always follow the script, but I think there are other possibilities. And
right. Yeah, I feel like, I moved to San Francisco for a little bit, you know, for a while back, a long time ago, and when the web was booming, and I didn't like San Francisco. Tall guy, when things were built for smaller, shorter people, so houses were not for me that they have out there. And there's like during the .com rush, I was like, hey, wait a minute, we're building this empire. Not this empire, but this whole like industry where you can work remotely. Why do I have to be in San Francisco for it to be a thing? And so, and it's been amazing. There's been a rise in co-working spaces. There's been a rise in remote working. Like I have a friend who I just went to New Orleans for an on-site visit for CISA DevConf, and I didn't even know he was in New Orleans because I expect him to be in South America or, you know, Asia or somewhere like, cause he's working like every month of the year outside the United States. And so he just happened to be in Orleans for a little bit. So that was crazy. But he's constantly moving. There's remote workers who have great jobs. They are based in New York City, but now they're like, they can work everywhere. So so there's people who are kind of trapped, I guess, from moving, but also there's people who were, you know, making a go of it. And so it's kind of crazy in terms of, you know, the style of working is totally different than our parents have. So.
It's a big shift, and trying to explain it to my parents is tricky. But I don't know, I guess I'm at 18 years of doing this at home, so I'm sort of used to it. Yeah. But yeah. I see where it's weird.
Yeah, but so I think the article just gave me pause about how things have changed so much. So
I worry that there are a lot of people for whom like remote work is not likely to be easy, or the people who are proposing it are scammers, because I see that in my email stuff all the time.
Yeah.
It's a hard transition, like figuring out what's a good job and how to get it. I don't think we know what we're doing these days as a country, culture, something like that.
Yeah. And there's a whole, I think we talked to Carl Smith about like how to do remote working too and how to make it work. So it's definitely not an easy thing to do, transition. So, all right, our next story.
Number one
is the Last Jedi trailer came out. Quickly hit 22 million views. That was on top of if you like going to movie theaters to watch trailers. I think last week is your Oscars, because Thor Ragnarok came out, which is a great trailer, and then Last Jedi dropped because the celebration at the Star Wars, you know, it's actually called Celebration at in Orlando happened, and so they released the Last Jedi trailer, which is coming out in December, and it's pretty awesome. And I felt like when I was watching it, I felt like I've seen this trailer before, and within a day or two, someone actually did a YouTube video and showed it side by side, the Force Awakens trailer and the trailer for The Last Jedi. And they're like pretty much beat for beat the same trailer. And so that's pretty cool. Like in terms of execution, I feel like I'm gonna be positive on this one. I can be negative on this one because of it. Like, oh, they're taking the cheap way out because Disney, who bought like Star Wars for $4 billion from George Lucas, has a lot riding on it. I think they got their money back already based off of toy sales and the success of Force Awakens and quasi success of Rogue One. Like, but so I'm kind of concerned, like, they kind of like, in terms of an art direction and artistry, I felt like, oh, it's a nice touch that they did that. That's my positive spin on it. My negative spin is it's like they're playing it too safe. They're continuing to play it safe with the Star Wars brand. And from what I know a little bit about what The Last Jedi happens, it's going to be a totally different feel and vibe than Force Awakens, which is great. I welcome that.
Right.
So my positive spin is just that it was a nice touch that they did the same thing, but still it was kind of eerie. It's like, hey, this is kind of like the same thing. But
consistency has its own virtues. Mm-hmm. And like, as you're saying, they make the movie really different, but a consistent trailer, but very different movies is appealing. Mm-hmm. I haven't told my kids the trailer's out for the Lego Ninjago movie. I think I'll wait on that for a while. Though there is a great teaser for it with Sensei Wu chasing a chicken up a roof, and it's just a disaster. So anyway, if you want something completely goofy, Lego Ninjago. But, you know, on the Star Wars thing, I'm also trying to be cautious because I loved the Rogue One trailer. The first one, I think it was, where they're like kind of bringing her in as a prisoner. And, you know, she's like, this is a rebellion, right? I rebel.
Right.
And I'm like watching the movie going, it's going to happen. Oh, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
The playing it safe, the stuff that they showed here, I think there's like less, it's just a teaser trailer.
Yeah.
So there's not that much. You know, they can still change things. I don't think the plot is locked in by the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very curious to see where it lands.
Right.
I'll also confess that like, I liked The Force Awakens, but like Rogue One made me really happy just because it finally had a plausible ending.
Oh yeah.
Everyone died. It made so much more sense, but nobody will like me for saying that.
Yeah. I think, the Rogue One trailer, I felt like, was great. And I felt like, I'm a big fan of, the rumor mills and what they had to do to,
change everything.
and the thing is, like, because Ghostbusters 3, the reboot or whatever, like, there was just so many from the rumor mills, whatever, and no matter what the official statement is, like, they did extensive reshoots to make that work, and it didn't make that much money, so you're not gonna probably see a sequel to it, but I appreciated the amount of effort it took to patch up Ghostbusters, and I'm even more appreciative of them, how much work I'm not sure why they did it, but like the to patch up Rogue One, because I think
it's crazy
because the rumors was like it was a good movie, but it wasn't a Star Wars movie, and they really wanted to play it safe,
right?
To make sure that they didn't alienate fans, and so there's a lot of things in the trailers for Rogue One that aren't in the movie, like you have people running.
Running
on the beach, like running into they filmed in a subway station. There wasn't any running around with a tape deck and a scissor.
Right.
The scene with the TIE fighter on top of the satellite dish, which is like,
iconic.
Yeah,
and not you.
Yeah, which is the iconic. Like, I think we're all waiting for that new iconic scene in modern Star Wars. Like modern Star Wars, like you have like Luke, hearing the bad news about his dad. And Cloud City all of them are flying through my head right now. Like in terms of Han Solo being frozen to Han Solo being thawed, so just
the Ewoks.
Not the Ewoks, but another Death Star. No, but yeah, so many great things. So just to see that TIE fighter and then not have it in Rogue One was kind of like, what? Like why aren't we having this? So
My family is totally eager to see it because they want to know more about Rey.
Yeah.
Kids are like, "Where? How is this connected? What's going on?" Mm-hmm. This is also something I shouldn't confess, but the one movie we don't have in the house is The Phantom Menace.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to the library to go get it.
Yeah.
They actually want to see it. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's good. Like I got the complete series on Blu-ray and I actually broke down and bought it. I think for the celebration, iTunes was having a sale on a 6-pack for the movies. So I bought all the movies on iTunes recently. And so I just, Phantom Menace. I mean, it's just, you just got to have it. just complete the train wreck of the trilogy.
Might as well have the set.
Yeah, exactly. So, for the trailer is great. It's pretty nice. It's going to be great to have a Star Wars movie for Christmas from here on out, pretty much for every Christmas, but it's pretty good. So, and also I just want to say Mystery Science Theater, new season is out.
Oh yes.
So I've seen 3 or 4 of the movies so far. So it's been great. So,
My local liquor store is doing something with Mystery Science 3000. I'm trying to figure out how that works, but
I guess that gives new meaning to binge watching.
That's it.
I'm not sure liquor and I guess it does go together. Bad movies, I guess that's pretty good.
Eases the bad movie pain or something.
Pretty good. Awesome. Cool. Well, that wraps it up. Simon, thanks for joining me on this news quest that we do every so often. But
always a pleasure.
Cool. How can people find you on the internet?
On Twitter, I'm at SIMONSTL. My ancient decaying website is SIMONSTL.com. Simon St. Laurent on LinkedIn. There is another Simon St. Laurent who lives in Quebec. That's not me.
Okay. That's good to know. Cool. Awesome. And cool. We'll hope to talk to you soon. Cool.
Awesome. Great. Thanks.
All right. Let me just find this button. If I can find this button, I'll turn off the call. Turn off the recording. That'd be great, Chris. I actually have no idea where this button is. Oh, there it is. All right,